Hi everyone, welcome back. Here we are, PodChat Live episode 113, recording on the 13th of February, 2024. Straight into the podcast as we always are with no intro music. I know we've brought this up in previous episodes. Craig, I had another email from someone this week saying, when are you guys going to add some music to the beginning and the end? And I don't know how you feel about it now, but I feel like it's like our trademark now. It's like we're just straight down to business, right? No music, no adverts, no nonsense.
Don't, well, it saves 10 seconds.
10 seconds of our nonsense instead, our chatting. So two things to get through this week. Firstly, something, well, sorry, let before I roll in, forgive me. How are you, Craig? Are you well?
No, I'm good. Yep. No, we've got a bit of bad weather in the state at the moment. A few pa More than a few places with no electricity, but yeah, we're surviving.
Lovely, good. That's good. Right. In the news this week, in the mainstream news, we'll come to the published work shortly. But in the mainstream news, caught my eye. I believe I'm right in saying she is a listener of the podcast, because I know she's engaged with some of our stuff on social media in the past. So if she is listening, and I hope I don't say her name incorrectly, I want to give a shout out to Jacqueline Simoneau, who is a third year DPM student at the University of Quebec. That's Doctor of Paediatric Medicine. She's also rather handy in artistic swimming. Artistic swimming is the what used to be called synchronized swimming. She's been to two Olympic Games, Rio and Tokyo, with this, but she's just last week become the world champion in artistic swimming in the championships held in Qatar. And as part of that, has her and her team have qualified as part of Team Canada for the Paris Olympics this year. So it'll be her third Olympic Games. So soon, I think she will be a qualified podiatrist in 2025, if I've got the duration of the degree in Quebec correct. So shout out to Jacqueline. That is awesome. We love giving shout outs to podiatry students who are sort of achieving things outside the world of podiatry. And most of the time we're doing it feels like we're doing it about running. So artistic swimming is definitely a bit different, isn't it?
Oh, that's really, really awesome. Yeah, it's but yeah, if anyone knows of any others who are achieving an elite sport, let us know.
Absolutely. Yeah, we love to know that stuff. Great. So what's been published in the last week? I hear you cry. Well, we've got two papers that have been published in the last week, but before we get to those, just one of them that was published actually a bit longer ago, only on the 1st of February. But we wanted to talk about it last week, but we just couldn't find a place to crowbar it in. But we will give it a quick hat tip now. This was published by a team in the United States. It's a short report in the Journal of Applied Physiology. It's open access. It is titled, "Habitually Wearing High Heels May Improve User Walking Economy in Any Footwear." So let me quickly summarize what they did before we chat about it. Small sample, as I said, only a short report, eight participants, and who they found who would agree to wear high heels as their daily shoes. And what they did was they tested them before and after a 14-week period of wearing high heels as their daily shoes. And they looked at their leg muscle and tendon structure and also their metabolism during walking in flat shoes before and after this 14-week period. Straight to the chase, what they found when it came to muscle tendon structure, perhaps unsurprisingly, 14 weeks of wearing high heels as your daily shoe leads to shorter medial gastroc fascicle lengths and also increased Achilles tendon stiffness. So that's the kind of changes we're getting at tissue level. Really interestingly, if the participants were walking more than 1,500 steps a day, then when they went back into flat footwear and walked, they had a 9% decrease in their net metabolic power. And for every 1,000 daily steps they took more, there was essentially again a decrease of about 5% in their metabolic power. Now, I'm no expert in this by a long way. My understanding of metabolic power is that it's a measure of the overall amount of energy required. So I read this as if it decreases, you're more efficient. Firstly, Craig, have I interpreted that correctly? And how the devil do we reconcile walking in high heels making you more efficient, metabolically speaking, when you go back to flats?
a number of things jump out at me. Firstly, is what great news for people who wear high heel shoes.
I can think of a few of our colleagues that will be delighted. Yeah.
Well, I'm specifically thinking of one person that we've had on a couple of times on our previous format of PodChat Live, and I'm sure she'd be delighted at this news.
She would.
Secondly, I'm not clear on the mechanism.
No.
It's I'm not the results look good. They're very cautious in the way they interpret them, but that's I don't have a problem with that. But what pops into your head is cross training. Like you cross train in sport to improve the economy of your whatever format you compete in, and this would be consistent with that. So, no, look, I think it's very interesting, very good news for high heel wearers. Lots of other bad reasons and reasons not to wear high heel shoes, but this is a reason to wear them. So,
Yeah, isn't it a nice bit of scientific balance to kind of the sort of shout outs that you see in the general media or indeed on social media, that kind of blanket statement that don't wear high heels, they're bad. There's been a lovely bit of nuance to it. So yeah, good news for the high heel wearers. I think we should entitle this episode when we upload it something clickbaity and eye-catching, like, are high heels are good for you or something, which is clearly not what this paper is saying, but we're going to play the we're going to play the game of trying to get people to listen. So let's move on to our papers that were published in the last 7 days. So this one is really interesting. I find this interesting for a couple of reasons. Bit of backstory of context. When Craig and I first came back to doing these weekly episodes, and we thought, okay, what should we do? What should we talk about? We made a little list of things that we would possibly speak about, and we just in case 1 week we're fairly light on the ground. And one of the things was, at the time, I was talking to one of the master students that I'm supervising, and they have to on their one of their modules, they have to do a literature review. So they have to come up with a topic that is of interest to them, perform a full review of the literature, hopefully. Write it up a publication if it's good enough. And we were sitting down and chatting, and she said to me she'd love to do something around foot orthoses. And I said, great, because as a supervisor, if it's a subject I am interested in as well, it makes life easier. And she said, how about we do a literature review on foot orthoses for Morton's neuroma? Because in my experience, I don't get great results. And I smiled ear to ear, and I was like, for 20 years, I maybe, it possibly speaks to me, in my hands as well. I get terrible results. Yet I speak to people who seem to get very, very good results. And foot orthoses are always on the list of things that are treated, used as part of a treatment strategy for Morton's neuroma. So when we looked into it, in the end, she couldn't do that project because there was not enough literature. And by not enough, I mean close to zero. Of any sort of value. Now, the reason I say that is that just in the, let's say, last week, 9th of Feb, so when was that? 4 days ago, wasn't it? There was a new Cochrane review published. Now, I'm sure most people know, but I always like to explain for the students just in case. The Cochrane database of systematic reviews is essentially the leading database for systematic reviews in healthcare. So systematic reviews are those big bits of work where you get all of the published work on a topic, filter out the rubbish studies, hopefully just get the high quality ones, synthesize them, and then you can write one paper where you can go to it and you can then read and that paper. And at that moment in time, you'll be up to date with the totality of the literature. And we've just had one published by a group of podiatrists. I think you know the lead author, Craig. I think they're out of Barry, yeah. I think they're out of QUT in Brisbane, from memory, yeah.
No, so
And this Cochrane review is simply entitled Treatments for Morton's Neuroma. So it's marvelous. Now, it's not the first Cochrane review to look at this topic, which Craig will give us in a second, I'm sure. And just so we're clear, it's called Treatments for Morton's Neuroma. Morton's Neuroma being the eponymous name for the intermetatarsal neuroma most often found in the third web space. So couple of things jumped out. And the great thing about a Cochrane review, if you do go and read it, particularly if you're a student and reading systematic reviews is a bit terrifying to you, the way that the Cochrane database asks you to write these reviews, you submit a sort of They either invite you to write one, or sometimes you submit a proposal and they accept it. Then they give you a really finite period of time to write it. And when you write it, you don't just write it up in scientific jargon. You have to write a lay version as well. So it's great for the lay population, but it's great for students as well. So if you go onto the, we'll link to it. If you go onto the link and scroll down, you can just go to sort of what do they call it? I think they call it plain language explanation. So you can just go to that as a student and it will just speak to you like you're a member of the public. The immediate thing that jumps out, a couple of things. It's a massive piece of work. I'll try and summarize. Only six RCTs included. Nothing else was considered to be of high enough quality. So for something that's, I would guess, easily the top five foot complaint that we see in clinic, doesn't sound, it feels like there's not a lot of high quality evidence out there. And it's worth noting when we talk about things like foot orthoses, like my student found out, and also we talk about things like mobilization and laser, things I know that are getting a lot of attention and discussion in the fora online. Absolutely none of those papers included either. Just nothing that was anywhere close to meeting the requirements, quality-wise, I assume. So essentially, they just looked at non-surgical, which was corticosteroid plus LA versus just LA, local anesthetic. Spoiler alert, little difference between the two. They looked at corticosteroid plus LA guided injection versus non-guided injection. Their conclusion, guided probably better, probably being the word they used. And that was the non-surgical they looked at. Surgical, they looked at neurectomies, plantar incision versus dorsal incision. And they found, with regards to satisfaction side effects, there was kind of little difference. Ultimately, the summary is rather underwhelming in that this is a really common condition, and we don't have a lot of evidence on how to treat it. Where do we go with this, Craig?
Oh, pass. I think it's extraordinary. As you said, it's a very, very common condition, and we have a range of treatments that we use. We like to think we do reasonably well at treating it. The evidence for any of those treatments that we commonly use just does not exist. That doesn't mean we shouldn't be doing it. It's just there's so little support for it. This is the second Cochrane review on Morton's neuroma. The first one, and I can't remember the date, but it might be maybe as far back as 20 years ago, and I think they reached a similar conclusion. So in 20 years, we've come nowhere in our evidence or the quality of that evidence for a Morton's neuroma. And again, like you said at the beginning, that foot orthoses seems to be commonly used. I can't say I've ever done very well using them. There was one study, Tim Kilmartin's from 1994, in which they tried to pronate and supinate a foot more to see what it did to neuroma symptoms, and it had no effect. So that wasn't exactly foot orthoses, but that's suggesting that foot function's not necessarily, or at least in the rear foot's related. So again, there's a lot of little comments in this review that really, quite exasperating, that lack of evidence for such a common disorder.
I mean, when we think about what the Cochrane database does, which is often, quite often, and there's massive amounts of topics on there from all different realms of healthcare. It often informs policy, amongst other things. I just feel we are miles away from anything close to a best practice guide, for want of a better word, for intermetatarsal neuroma. I didn't realize there was such a lack of evidence. For it, kind of, on this kind of grand scale, which is really, really fascinating. Because, like you say, it's incredibly common. We all see it a lot. Lots of people are doing things for it, talking about what they're doing for it, talking about the results they're getting. But there doesn't seem much evidence to inform us.
But I mean, having said that, there are quite a few studies that weren't included in this review because they weren't considered quite good enough to include. That doesn't mean we should sort of ignore them. And again, I'm thinking, manipulation, techniques like that, laser, there has been work done on them, shockwave, there has been work done on that. They're just not
Just not good quality work.
out enough. Free from enough bias to be included in a formal systematic review. But also, like, I don't know what you would stand to do, but if I'm confronted with a Morton's neuroma, it's not of long standing duration. I mean, wider shoes and a met dome, neither of those have been studied, yet that's what I typically would do,
I'll
which is
always remember one of your. It was a quote that you used to say many, many years ago. It probably wasn't about Morton Jeromo, but it's the way I feel about it, which is like you say. Yep, yeah, if someone comes in, what tell them to put go into wider shoes and then refer them to your enemies. Do you remember saying
Yeah.
that? So researchers out there, students out there, people who are into Morton Jeromo, more high quality research, please. That would be delightful. Lastly. And this is a paper that is online now, but it's one of those online sort of ahead of print papers. So it's currently scheduled for the April 2024 edition, volume 65 of Seminars in Arthritis and Rheumatism. So it's pretty much just been released in the last few days, but it's not technically got a publication date yet. And this is fascinating because this is something I'm certain anyone who's been in practice for more than a year will have had this conversation with their patients. And the title is, and it's from a group of researchers from Australia, Come Rain or Shine, Is Weather a Risk Factor for Musculoskeletal Pain? A Systematic Review with Meta-Analysis of Case Crossover Studies. So lots of work that's been published on this in the past. We know that we have patients that come in that either tell us that their pain in their knee or their big toe or their hip, wherever it may be, is worse because of the weather. Or some of them will even say they can predict when the weather's going to be bad because they wake up and then their hip is sore, which tells them it's going to rain that day. A fascinating kind of perhaps unexplained or misunderstood relationship between musculoskeletal pain and the weather. I remember many years ago on Podiatry Arena having a chat with Kevin Kerb, well, having a discussion on the forum about it. And I think it was maybe about 15 years ago, 2010, 2009, something like that. And I just said, I don't understand the mechanism by which this is potentially, what's the thought process of how this could occur? And Kevin Kirby talked to me about, he gave me a physics lesson about what happens to a bag of crisps or potato chips, as he calls them. What do you call them in Australia? Crisps or chips?
Chips.
Chips, yeah, we're weird in England. We call them crisps. But yeah, what happens if you take a bag up at high altitude? And what you see is the bag just kind of puffs out and gets really taut because of the difference in air pressure inside the bag, which remains constant, and the air pressure at altitude. So I think the theory has been something similar around joint capsules and the barometric pressure, the change in barometric pressure in the air in different climates. Anyway, this systematic review suggested that despite all the anecdotes that we get from patients about the changes in weather and their musculoskeletal pain, weather changes do not seem to increase the risk of knee, hip, or low back pain symptoms. However, high temperatures combined with low humidity could double the risk of a gout flare, which I think is particularly interesting for us, given that gout, although it can affect any joint, tends to affect the big toe joint more than most. And their conclusions, therefore, were that we should exercise caution when recommending pain management based on weather parameters. I don't know how many people are doing that. I guess, they're kind of tempering their comments there. How many? You've been in practice many, many years, Craig. I mean, you must have heard some stories over the years from patients about the link between their pain and weather.
Oh, you see it every week. Yeah, there's no doubt about that. It's and these anecdotes are very real. It's quite extraordinary. But the I am aware of some studies that have sort of shown that, yeah, maybe it is. Other studies showing maybe it's not. But when you put them all together, which is what this systematic review did, said, well, yeah, just in gout. But again, the mechanism. There's the barometric pressure in joints. But there's also, and again, I'm not clear on the evidence on this, but what about the sensitivity of the pain nerve endings with changes in humidity? So conditions are not flaring up, but the nerve endings are becoming more sensitive. And there are plausible mechanisms. But again, actually, it comes back to what we talked about a few episodes ago about when a study contradicts your anecdotal beliefs. You try telling people who experience this. This study shows that, well, no, you're not experiencing this. It's going to be challenging.
I suspect if you tell a patient that their real-world experience is not true, that is a surefire way and a complete shortcut to fracturing any kind of therapeutic alliance you're trying to build in a consultation.
Oh, I know. And that's why I sort of tend to latch onto that. Perhaps humidity changes the pain sensitivities,
Yeah,
from the
I'll
evidence.
be honest. I don't know much about that myself. I've got a friend who's particularly sharp on nociceptors and things. I might drop him a text when we finish recording and ask him if there's anything about nociceptors and their sensitivity and, different humidities or air pressures, etc. Because there's something there, isn't there?
I mean, I hate to think how many times over the years I've heard people say, "Oh, my bunion's playing up, it's going to rain tomorrow."
And does it rain tomorrow?
Interestingly, often it does, but it's
But
whether
they're saying it in rainy
but
season.
no, the weather forecast said it was going to rain. So whether they've left that to explain an exacerbation in symptoms, or whether their bunion isn't really playing up, it's just the pain sensitivity has changed because of the humidity, or some other mechanism that's led them to believe. So yeah, again, it's a point for conversation. You do have to be careful what you say as part of those conversations.
You do. And humans, the easiest person for us to trick is ourselves. And we're constantly looking for patterns that aren't there. And we're always falling foul to the post hoc fallacy, where just because something happens after something, it doesn't mean just because B happens after A, it doesn't mean A caused B. But yep, I think, with this one, don't take it into clinic and tell patients that, when patients that come and tell you, often if someone says to me, I know it sounds silly, but my knee tells me when it's going to rain. I'm not going to come back with them and say, well, the latest systematic review tells you that your lived experience is incorrect. I often say to them, you know what? Loads of people say that to me. And then I kind of leave it there. It's kind of, don't illegitimize their very genuine kind of experience. But at the same time, be mindful that, there's not massive amounts of evidence behind it, seemingly, but a fascinating area, which I'm sure many people have had discussions with. If you have had discussions with patients about this, if you've got your own thoughts, theories, or of research that's overwhelmingly sort of pointing towards for or against this, please do email us. We'd love to see it. It's as always, it's getinvolved@podchatlive.com. And email us about any other thing as well. As I always say, in the wrap up here at the end, email us, message us on social media. We are Podchat Live across all social media. Lastly, I said to you, I'm not going to stop begging for ratings and reviews on our podcast things until I hit 50. We are currently at 47 on Spotify. So just three of you listening right now, if you enjoy the podcast, just open up your app. Hit the rate button. It'll take a few seconds, if that. We'll get to 50 and I'll shut up about it. On Apple, we're still at 25. So those Apple listeners, come on, get with the program. Spotify listeners are winning that battle.
I wonder why they're different. Because we get more listeners, but yeah.
And the other thing as well is, and I think, I don't know the reason to this, but we know roughly how many listeners we have, and it's a massive number compared to how many people have left ratings. So it's such a small percentage that leave ratings. And I thought to myself, why? Why would you not? And then I suddenly realized, I went on to the I've got five or six podcasts that I, subscribe to and I listen to every week on my runs or on my commute. And I suddenly looked at how many of those I'd rated, and I'd not rated any of them. So I thought to myself, it's easily done. So I've gone on to the podcast that I listen to and I consume and enjoy regularly, and I've given them all ratings. So I don't feel guilty about begging for ratings for our podcast. So that has been the week in podiatry. We will be back next week, as always, to bring you whatever we has caught our eye or been published in the next 7 days. And we hope you can join us. Thanks, Craig.
Right, thanks. See you next week.